Muddy Knees Media.
For the rest of this month being September 2020, you can take out a subscription to The Athletic for the frankly ridiculous price of just £1 a month. That's unrivaled football writing and analysis from the very best people in the business, a brand spanking new breaking news service, and ad-free versions of each Athletic podcast, all for just £1 a month. Go to theathletic.com/totally to get started.
Totally Football Show. Today, round two of the Premier League season. Zaha scores in Manchester, nothing to do with the manager's daughter, while at Saints it's a son who's putting it about in a massive win for Spurs. We round up all the stories in a busy weekend for goals. Plus, we'll check in on Pirlo. How'd that debut go? We get a heads up from James Horncastle. It's the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hello, listener. What a pleasure to have you with us. It is Monday, the 21st of September. Hope you're well. And here to talk us through the round two action in the Premier League, we have author and football writer for The Eye, Daniel Story.
Hi, James.
Hello, Daniel. Shy retiring Liverpool observer Sasha Gurionov is with us.
Hello, James.
Hello, Sasha. And a man who went from Saints to Devils over the summer, Carl Anker.
Hello, James.
Hey, Carl. You just come back for your first professional trip to Old Trafford. Woof.
Yeah. Very strange being sat in the Theatre of Dreams. That was mostly empty.
Dreams. Yes. Big scoring weekend, of course. I make it 39 in 8 matches so far in round two, which is 4.875 per game. Almost 5 goals a game. That's incredible. And if we get a meagre 5 goals across the two fixtures on Monday, that'll make this the record goal-scoring weekend ever in the Premier League, at least since they went to 20 games. What's behind it? That's the big buzz question. What's behind it, Daniel Story?
A combination, I suppose, of bad defending in brackets general. I think teams are playing with high lines, Southampton are an obvious example, and kind of getting caught. But I do also think that there's a general kind of shortened pre-season argument for it, in that managers seem pretty slow to change things that aren't working. You know, we don't have the drink spikes anymore, and that certainly is was an occasion in which they intervened. But yeah, it just feels like the teams that start to play badly aren't really addressing that. And you know, maybe we should look at the flip side and say that there's some very, very good forwards in the Premier League as well. So it's not necessarily just bad defending.
That's very true. You were pointing out earlier that we've now had as many hat tricks in 2020-21 as we did in the whole of the 2006-2007 seasons. Crouch, Drogba and Rooney, the only three players to get hat-tricks in the whole of that campaign. We've already had Salah, Calvert-Lewin and Son. Madness. Well, the scores, and they are crazy. It began Saturday lunchtime with Everton's 5-2 victory over West Brom. Also on Saturday, Arsenal saw off West Ham by a comparatively meagre 2-1. Leeds had another 4-3. This time they were on the right end of it, at home to Fulham, and Palace went to Old Trafford, Palace, and won 3-1. On Sunday, Spurs roared back from last week's disappointment and from going a goal down in this one with a 5-2 win over Saints. Brighton won 3-0 at Newcastle. Mane had Kepa for breakfast, as Liverpool did Chelsea 2-0. And Leicester went top of the league for the first time since they won it, with their 4-2 win over Burnley. Still to come on Monday, Wolves will be up against Man City and Aston Villa will take on Sheffield United. But we're going to begin at Stamford Bridge.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Whoa, given by Kepa. Arita Balaga, another catastrophe for him, and Sadio Mane has his second. It's totally gift-wrapped by the goalkeeper.
Liverpool 2-0 winners at Chelsea on Sunday afternoon. Daniel, you've been doing winners and losers for Football 365. Hope you kept a couple of places free for this one.
Yeah, I mean, I feel for Kepa in that, you know, any professional in any industry, particularly one under the pretty bright glare of the spotlight, suffering such a devastating loss of form, or not even really a loss of form, just never really shown any form. It's not pleasant for him, and he will be going through it as everyone piles on the criticism. But he, the performances justify it, because every week now there's a catastrophic error which ultimately helps decide Chelsea's results. And I'm surprised that Lampard has kept faith with him at the beginning of this season. I thought he'd probably play Caballero, particularly given that there was clearly going to be a new goalkeeper signed and Edouard Mendy will be coming in this week. So it just felt like playing him was almost no win, in that you were only ever going to drop him after two or three games anyway. But that aside, he should still have done better with, you know, with the opportunity he was given this season and last. And it was another catastrophic error for Mane's second goal.
On Kepa, I mean, it's like a gradual deterioration. You could see in the first half, even today, there was a couple of times that his own defenders wouldn't pass the ball back to him, as it turned out, with good reason. I actually think he probably has a good part to play in the sending off as well, because there's clearly mistrust between the defenders and the goalkeeper, who comes when and how. All right, the Chelsea defence was switched off and not aware to the counter-attack, or in fact where Mane was, but neither was Kepa, and Kepa can actually see the pitch in front of him. And I think when it comes to the 2-0, the blocked clearance, or actually the blocked pass, Klopp said after the game that one of the things we're going to do is chase the goalkeeper the whole game, and it's really nice to see it come off. Because when Shreves, I think, asked him, is like, you know, did you enjoy the fact that Mane kept going? But even Mane was trying to explain, I didn't keep going because I was angry. We knew exactly how to close down the passes from the goalkeeper. So they targeted him, they got the reward, and at the moment, yeah, he's... the thing is, at that stage of the game as well, you're down to 10 men, 1-0, 2-0 just kills the whole thing. And that's what he does to his team at the moment.
With Kepa's in the losers column, is Sadio Mane among the winners? It was he who brought the red card after him latching onto that wonderful long pass from Jordan Henderson. So Andreas Christensen executes him. Pretty hands-on, last-ditch defending.
Bear hug.
Indeed. And then, of course, he pops up with a couple of goals.
He is obviously a winner this weekend in that he scored Liverpool's two goals. But I think generally the intensity of that front three over the first two games will really impress Jurgen Klopp, because we talk about complacency. And I think there's two ways that we generally see complacency. One is a sort of general lethargy across the team, which I think we would be a surprise under a Klopp team. I know there was a drop-off at Dortmund, but in slightly different circumstances, without constantly fighting from behind in terms of Bayern Munich's dominance. But the other way is a kind of inexactness in the final third. And actually, over the first, you know, the first two weekends of the season, they have been pretty lethal. You know, their defending wasn't brilliant against Leeds. It didn't have to be brilliant against Chelsea for most of it. But the way that front three seems to have clicked straight back into gear after a short break and almost seem intent on outscoring each other, it almost looks like a personal duel of, you know, I'm going to be the first to 10 goals and then I'm going to be the first to 15 and 20 and we're going to get Roberto Firmino to score at Anfield in the league. And there just seems to be that really healthy competition between them. And now with Diogo Jota coming in, healthy competition for places as well.
And let's also give some more credit to Firmino as well, because he's very cute movement before he sets up Mane. And also when the second goal comes, he actually tells Mane, go, points him to where he should be closing down the pass, and that's exactly where the pass goes. I also think a big winner today is Fabinho. I mean, I know eyebrows were raised, but Fabinho has actually played at centre-back one-on-one with Werner. He did very well a couple of times. So I think there's lots of encouraging things for Liverpool throughout all the lines, and that's even before we mentioned Thiago.
Let's mention Thiago then. Go on then, Sasha.
Well, Thiago did lots of passing. But I thought it was a good game for him to come in, as Klopp said after the game, because when Liverpool had a stranglehold on the game, I thought anyway, Chelsea were completely penned back, to be honest. And then you go a man up, very gentle introduction, an introduction where he could even do a midfielder's sort of challenge for the penalty, where he kind of just comes running back in the box, guys, I'm going to help. Oh, yeah, I helped you, really. And so I thought it was a gentle introduction for him, given the sort of high-level game this is, so a bit more confidence for him. And yeah, pass. Perhaps the thing at Liverpool midfield has been missing under Klopp.
75 successful passes. That's the most ever in the Premier League by a player who's only played a maximum of 45 minutes, which, you know, he did. As you say, it was a slightly gentle fixture for him to come into at Chelsea, a man down from Christensen's red card. Ankur1911 says, beyond all of that, should questions be asked of Frank Lampard? His tactical choices have baffled, to say the least, says Ankur. Buy a Ferrari and drive like a Corolla.
Yeah, Frank Lampard has definitely been one of a slightly tactical naive formats, especially in the game against Brighton. I think he kind of got it better on the Sunday. There was definitely a game plan, and the counter attack, suck him up, and then spin out to Timo Werner on a counter attack is not the most complicated of ideas, but it certainly looked as if it was okay for the first 40 minutes. I think one of the big problems with Chelsea, that has been a prolonged problem with Chelsea, is that no matter what Frank Lampard does, he has centre-backs for varying, pluses and minuses that are all very, very quiet. Sasha has just talked about how Kepa was, sort of played into that mistake from Christensen that involved the red card. That doesn't happen if you have a centre-back that talks a lot. That doesn't happen if you have a centre-back that shouts man on left, right, and does the basic stuff, which again goes back to just sort of Chelsea never properly replaced Gary Cahill. And isn't that a very strange statement to say? A lot's going to be asked of Thiago Silva, not just to play in the high line and hope in his, I don't want to say advanced age, 35 plus years, he's got the legs for it. But also, can he just constantly yell at a back four that is very, very quiet? Christensen's very quiet. Zouma's very, very quiet. Tomori, first game he's played since February, a bit better. But again, a young colt comparatively, and is also quite a quiet centre-back. I don't know how you coach that.
Again, perhaps the difficulty is they're all really nice lads. Because whenever I've interviewed them after the games, they're all really calm. You're really composed 10 minutes after they've been running around. And I was speaking to Christensen last year, and I was like, he looked like a lost student who kind of wandered into this post-match interview area. And I just think, there doesn't seem to be enough oomph around that those centre-backs and Kepa as well. Someone to actually take what's going on and tell people what to do. And they take the defensive part of the game by the scruff of the neck. So maybe this is where Thiago comes in, but does he have the language to actually order these guys about? They would know his reputation, but I think this is a situation where perhaps he has to do a bit more micromanagement.
Is there a danger of piling too much criticism on Chelsea for this game? What did you make of the first 45 minutes while it was still 11-11?
I mean, as Carl says, they had a game plan, which was to kind of soak up Liverpool's pressure and use that counter-attack, almost those direct passes that we saw Calvin Phillips do for Leeds last weekend, the kind of quarterback passes from either holding midfielder or central defender to a wide forward, and it was Timo Werner in most of the time. I'm not completely enamoured with this idea of Chelsea going long, which they seem to have done against Brighton and against Liverpool, when you've just created arguably one of the most fluid front lines in Europe, and now you're starting to hit it long to players who are more comfortable with ball at feet. I don't really get that, but maybe Liverpool is a hard game to judge that on. The problem with playing that kind of reactive football, that reactive plan, is that as soon as something goes wrong and you don't have anything to, you don't have a second gear or you don't have any resilience to respond, it leaves, not in this case, but it generally leaves supporters leaving the ground thinking, well, we didn't even really try there. We've just kind of lost without giving it a go. We've not laid a glove on the opponent. And that's why sometimes managers prefer this kind of blood and thunder football, because at least people feel like, hang on, at least we gave it a go. At least we tried to throw a few punches rather than just sitting back and eventually kind of losing on points.
Mm. A quick word on Havertz. While Werner looked lively, Havertz not so much. If this was the ideal fixture for Thiago to make his debut in, Thiago Alcantara, this has been a very difficult kind of couple of games for Kai Havertz to try and find his feet in Frank's side.
Yeah, and I think he was operating out wide against Brighton, which didn't quite make sense, especially when you look to the players Frank Lampard was sort of using as 3-8s or number 10s, and then now to work as a number 10 in a game where you're trying to play quite direct doesn't quite make sense. Frank Lampard has an embarrassment of riches, and he has, what would you like to call the nice headache, but it's going to take a while. I think this season's going to be quite fun because you've got the international tournament hangover that we often like to say after a World Cup without having the international tournament. And the managers that are responding to this are the managers that are going, hang on, let's take this back to basics. So as Daniel just said, you're seeing managers not really have a plan B, and it all just looks a bit flat. And I think that will extend to a number of teams we saw this weekend of their preferred plan A was not possible due to reasons regarding fatigue, fitness, or personnel issues. And then realizing they don't have a plan A because they're so concerned with this, in air quotes, philosophy.
Does he have a while though? Because he was speaking after the game again that he needs to have time. But given the pressures at Chelsea and the fact that he's expected to achieve more this season and the fact they're playing every 3 to 4 days, is he actually going to have enough time to coach this team into something? Because it's, you know, there's a lot of travel, there's a lot of coming back, there's a lot of recovery. And, you know, in the past, you know, when coaches speak about times like this, they say, look, it's the one who really have time to recover, can't do much coaching. He has half a dozen new players and a style he's trying to change. Is he actually going to get the chance to do that without this descending into a complete mess?
Yeah, we did suggest before the season started that the more settled sides might be the ones that had less of a disadvantage from the incredible succession of games that teams are currently facing. That said, a big squad is going to be crucial, I imagine, which is why Diogo Jota's arrival at Liverpool has got you beaming, eh, Sasha?
So on Wednesday, I thought things looked quite bleak. I looked at Liverpool's accounts. I didn't think they had that much money, and it was quite down. And then it comes on Friday, and they pay $5 million up front for Thiago Alcantara. They pay $4 million up front, offset by Hoover for Diogo Jota, who can now play anywhere across the front three. And yeah, it's actually quite exciting because I think within the space of a couple of days, the kind of picture and outlook for Liverpool's season perhaps has changed. Maybe there will be a way that, for example, Wijnaldum could stay. Perhaps they will sell a couple more peripheral members of the squad. But, you know, given that they've got $9 million for Hoover, I think that's very good going to fund the other purchases. But I think the negotiation process by which Liverpool got these two players this week certainly is a massive, massive win. And I'm really, really impressed with how they actually managed to do it. Of course, they didn't invent the concept of payment by installments. But in a situation where they're quite cash poor, to drive quite such a high bargain, to agree these terms, for example, they couldn't do this for Werner, I think they've done really, really well. And now, also in terms of age, perhaps I'm being a little bit too neurotic, because I look at Thiago and say, okay, he's the best player in the Champions League final. And I'm thinking, oh, he's 29. Give it a couple of years, they're all going to be in their 30s and fall off a cliff. Whereas you see the other teams, you know, Everton have, you know, James and Allen, they're both 29. Bale's 31, Aubameyang's 31, signed a new contract, and all these other guys are excited. And I'm thinking, oh, what about the age profile of Liverpool? So this is where Diogo Jota is fantastic, because he's 23. He is perfect.
Well, from Liverpool's triumph to a very different story for their rivals in Manchester, Crystal Palace's win at Old Trafford next.
This season, the Premier League's going to be a little bit different. But at Paddy Power, we're trying to embrace the new normal by looking at the upside. Avoid unnecessary journeys, that's Fulham's trip to Anfield off. Fake crowd noise, the Emirates has never sounded so good. Self-isolate, well, some midfielders do that very effectively. Avoid European travel, shouldn't be a problem for Everton fans. When you think about it, not that much has changed, really. New normal, same old football. Paddy Power. 18+, begambleaware.org.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Saturday evening, Man United 1, Crystal Palace 3. Yep, Palace not just winning, but scoring 3 goals. That's the first time they've scored more than twice in 40 Premier League matches.
Yeah, and I thought one of the kind of low-key tactical masterstrokes of the weekend was Roy Hodgson giving Wilfried Zaha the captain's armband. It's not been an easy summer for Wilfried Zaha, and he's made it very clear he would like to leave. He turns 28 in November, and I think he sees his big chance of a second big move, a kind of big move redemption story frittering away, and that can be very frustrating for a player. And some players in that scenario would sulk or kick up a fuss or trying to engineer a move more vehemently than he has. He said he wants to leave, but Palace have been very honest with him and said, unless anyone pays the fee, and we don't think they will, then you're not going anywhere. But his response has been to lead Palace over the first two games of the season and lead a Palace side without Eberechi Eze starting, without Michy Batshuayi starting, and they will take responsibility off Zaha, and that is crucial for him because he will only become one of the best attacking midfielders again in the Premier League if he doesn't have two or three markers on him every week. And well done for Roy Hodgson for making captain, well done to him for embracing that, and well done for him for performing brilliantly at the ground that his career looked to have sort of gone off the rails at, because it would have been very easy, as I say, for him to kick up a fuss and sulk this summer, and it doesn't sound like he's done any of that.
Two goals in this game following up the goal he scored last weekend against Southampton. Andros Townsend with the other goal here for Palace. That penalty, though, first of all, to give it, then the fact that it was retaken with a different penalty taker the second time. Wakefield Neil says, how was Zaha allowed to retake the penalty? This must be in the rules, but it seems wrong. What did you think of the handball decision anyway, Carl?
It's the rule. It's the letter of the law now. If it
is it though?
I was giggling deliriously over that 3 minute period. It was very much. If that's the handball law, then one has to enforce it. And De Gea was off his line, so therefore you have to ask for a retake. I must admit, I was not aware that you could change the penalty taker on a retake. But in my sort of frantic typing afterwards, I found out that this has happened, and this has happened in cases of encroachment before as well. So yes, a very, very silly 5 minutes. But I'm reluctant to say that's why Crystal Palace beat Manchester United. They were very good. They played in a very good 4-4-2. They overloaded the left side and made most of the weaknesses in Daniel James and Timmy Vassalo-Mensah on the right-hand side. And they left Manchester United with not much to do in terms of attacking play, other than having pot shots from afar.
75% possession United have.
Sterile possession. It was really sterile possession. I think Manchester United, and I think the way Solskjaer wants United to play, he wants them to play this sort of very modern style of football where you press and you have two attacking fullbacks getting forward, but he doesn't quite have the personnel for that. I was talking to Duncan Alexander about how to best describe United's play, and he said they're a bit like the demo version of FIFA. If Liverpool and Manchester City are playing in 2020, United are playing roughly in 2018, in that they've got some very, very good, very, very intelligent football players that are, when they're confident, playing out their skin. But when they're not, they don't really know what they're doing. There can be a mess in team shape, and they are over-reliant on two or three key team members. When you saw that lineup, and there was no Wan-Bissaka to secure the right wing, and there was no Nemanja Matic to protect a centre-back pairing that really should not be playing in a high line, alarm bells ring for Manchester United fans, and Solskjaer couldn't really adapt.
And I think this is one problem I have with the whole hoo-ha around VAR. They were exposed like that two or three times before. It's something like that was coming. And also this in-game learning is absent. And I think also the preparation seems to be somewhat wanting, because the first goal was the mirror image of the goal that Palace scored last week. They know that Palace like to do this. And also in terms of how they were playing, they came up against this wall in the center of the park. And watching the game, you could just see there's just a mass of Palace players. And they just had absolutely no imagination about how to try to go around it, even tried to get it wide and tried to get to create some space. They couldn't even do that.
Michael Cox at the start of last season wrote a piece for The Athletic arguing that the top six sides are best defined by the people that play in the number six, the sort of deep lying midfielder. And Manchester United have Fred, Scott McTominay and Nemanja Matic, which is like a very bad game of rock, paper, scissors. And none of those three players can truly stamp their will upon a game in the way that Manchester United want to do consistently. When so much of Manchester United's defensive game plan is Aaron Wan-Bissaka is one of the best defenders 1v1 in the league, and he will shut down the right-hand side, so therefore our centre-backs can play forward. To play with the same high line without Wan-Bissaka is very silly. When you don't have Wan-Bissaka to shut down the right-hand side and you don't have Nemanja Matic to drop deep, Victor Lindelof becomes a liability. So to persist with two very slow centre-backs and try and play with that high line when you don't have the two players that protect that high line is naive at best.
Gary Neville says, you can talk about Sancho, which we haven't done, but I take your point. But United will never win the league with that defensive partnership, Maguire and Lindelof. Never, adds Gary, in case we missed it the first time. Would you agree with that summary? Daniel, you're nodding.
Yeah, I would also say, and I've said it until I'm almost blue in the face on this podcast, I think they have a manager that reflects them as a team, in that there doesn't seem to be a huge amount of tactical depth there. There are flashes of brilliance, particularly against big six rivals, in which you can see something happening. But it I said it about Arsenal under Emery last week, but it just kind of feels like it happens almost by roll of the dice rather than necessarily pre-planning. And without that pre-planning, you can see how Manchester United go on a run of good form when tails are up, because Solskjaer is an arm round the shoulder, you're all brilliant manager. there just seems to me to be an absolute dearth behind that, that when things aren't going so well, either in-game or over a period of games, there doesn't seem to be a handbrake to that bad form, because it's just a kind of, let's hope that the next game is the one that we play well in, rather than let's have a plan to make sure that the next game we play in is the one that we win. And I don't think they'll finish outside the top six, and I don't think they'll even finish outside the top four, but I don't think there'll be a title challenger, whoever they buy under this manager.
Right. The next game for United will be red-hot Luton Town. That's right, the same Hatters outfit who have won four games out of four in all competitions this season after winning four out of four in pre-season as well. That's coming up Tuesday at Kenilworth Road. Just on the subject, Carl, of your defined by whoever's wearing the number six thing, you probably saw this story that kind of re-emerged, or emerged for some, this weekend about the fact that Thiago Alcantara was actually due to be joining Man United, that Sir Alex Ferguson had actually set this deal up, and then David Moyes went, who is this Thiago Alcantara? Not sure about him, and shut it down again. And that equally, David Moyes, in his turn, had made arrangements for Toni Kroos to be joining the Red Devils, only for Louis van Gaal to say, no, thank you. Nathan McGill says, hey, chaps, any chance for a flip reverse on one of the coming shows in which Fergie stays at United, gets Alcantara, and then Moyes and Fellaini stay at Everton and Martinez remains at Wigan? Does he still go on to be Belgian manager, says Nathan, presumably of Martinez? That's a, there's a world of kind of alternate realities in that question.
That's,
it's an interesting one, isn't
there? Very tasty one.
But again, I mean, you know, Carl has said this, and I know I have, but well-functioning super clubs shouldn't be in a position where the new manager is necessarily dictating. Yes, they have a say in that transfer policy, but in Moyes' defence, it sounds like Ryan Giggs had some input on that decision as well and said, you know, I don't think he's really good enough. But should an assistant manager or a coach at that point really be the one dictating transfers? If you have someone in those positions to do that, they have already identified that he is a right fit, and therefore the deal is done. I don't. It feels like the tail wagging the dog.
You know what I'm going to say. You know what I'm going to say.
Listeners, how's your hairline doing in this fine year of 2020? Well, despite being from a long line of follically challenged males, I am, at the age of 40, still blessed with a full head of hair, with no need for a Jack Charlton comb-over or any evidence of a looming Attilio Lombardo situation up top. Now, some of you may not be so lucky, and some of you may not wish to rock the look that our very own James Richardson has perfected over the last two decades. So that's where Hims comes in. Hims provides an easy-to-use, trustworthy and science-backed service for men suffering from hair loss, helping men to be the very best versions of themselves by connecting them with licensed healthcare providers to help with hair loss problems. With Hims, there are no more awkward in-person doctor visits or hushed conversations at the pharmacy. You get a proper online appointment and some sound advice on what you can do to help your hair before it's too late. All you have to do is head to forhims.co.uk/athletic to start your free consultation today and check out the full details and all their safety information. That's forhims, forhims.co.uk/athletic. One more time, forhims.co.uk/athletic.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power.
Kane and Son, who's up with him. He's worked it into Son again. I do not believe it. It is brilliant. The Son and Kane show keeps on going.
Quite the lunchtime game on Sunday at St Mary's as Southampton hosted Spurs. Kyle, this used to be your beat. Tell us what happened.
What happened was Southampton played much like how they have often played, which is nose and knee and tight footwork, Danny Ings doing Danny Ings things.
Wonderful goal, no?
Fantastic take. Danny Ings' renaissance is a real nice, edifying thing and evidence of what happens when a striker is confident and when a striker finally gets a good run of form. So he was doing very well. And then Southampton did what they often want to do, which is sort of shoot themselves in the foot, especially just before halftime. Really good counter-attacking goal. Fantastic little roulette by Ndombele as well. And then Son, I think Son is one of the best counter-attacking forwards in England, if not in European football. And then from then on, Southampton were chewed up.
So this was weird because until that point, Spurs had looked much the same kind of team who'd capitulated against Everton the previous week. there but not really there. And the two lively people have been Son, of course, and Ndombele, who kind of marauded through the Saints midfield to set Kane and then Son up for that opening goal. So then at half time, Mourinho takes Ndombele out of the lineup and everyone's going mad on social media. But hey, presto, Spurs score one and then another and then another. And it ends up being 5-2 with Son scoring four, all four of which were assisted by Harry Kane, which is the first time in Premier League that one player has assisted the other for all four goals. What happened? Is this Jose's master plan? How can we compute all this?
I think what happened, it's the other new signing Tottenham Hotspur made, Pierre-Emile Højbjerg. So formerly Southampton captain, goes to Tottenham Hotspur, nominally because Højbjerg is very, very good at winning the ball and passing it to more talented personnel. And Southampton still haven't replaced him. So Højbjerg left. Harrison Reed, the person you know was supposed to come back from loan from Fulham to do that, stays at Fulham. So Southampton can buy other players. And Southampton have not bought another midfielder in. Oriol Romeu, their number six, goes off some way through the second half. And they just get bullied in the middle of the park. Højbjerg, you know, is doing very basic things winning the ball, giving it to Harry Kane, who's in that sort of number 10 area where he can thrive. And he's got a fantastic range of passing when he wants to. And they're just playing very simple balls over the top because Southampton are a team that wants to play with a high defensive line, that need to always apply pressure on the ball because Ralph Hasenhüttl doesn't really trust these two centre-backs. So they try and press high up the pitch so there's less time on the ball in front of those two centre-backs. But the moment you get over them, when you've got a player as two-footed and as quick as Son, it's game over.
Could there be an argument that the reason Ndombele was taken off is to free up space for Kane to drop into? Because that's what certainly it looked like. And he came short twice, they scored the two goals. He went wide again, they scored the two goals. And I think what we saw in this game, I've seen Kane to do this before, but perhaps not to such devastating extent. He would drop and go wandering looking for the ball, but this time he seemed to know exactly when to drop and where to go. So because he's assisted from either wing, he assisted from the deep, and he showed that range of passing that he has. I remember it was a game against Liverpool, which I think Spurs lost, but he set up one of the goals by this like reverse 40-yard ball. So when the fourth goal goes in, I was like, I've seen this before. So he has this range of passing, except sometimes when he goes wandering, it's just he doesn't really get anywhere. Maybe in this situation, Mourinho actually did some coaching, saw that space that he could go into, and this is where Kane became so frighteningly efficient. I absolutely love this performance from him.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think it bodes really well for both Tottenham and for England, because we've talked in the past about like split striker roles where the strikers split off to the wing. This is almost the reverse of that. If you play Heung-Min Son and Gareth Bale either side of Harry Kane and he effectively drops into midfield and plays the passes, you've then got two players doing that. I mean, Southampton were unable to stop Heung-Min Son running in behind. If you've got Gareth Bale as another player doing it, it's going to be incredibly hard to stop. And if Tottenham are successful at doing that, England, with two of Raheem Sterling, Jadon Sancho and Marcus Rashford playing the same role, that strikes as a brilliant option. I mean, I think Kane is a goal scorer and loves scoring goals. So I suspect he would be slightly wary of not being more selfless, because I don't think he's a selfish player necessarily. But I think he would also like to be seen primarily as the first choice number nine goal scorer. But the ability to play both of those roles and to switch between those roles in the same game indicates a tactical awareness of Kane that maybe we'd overlooked before. I think we always knew he could play that pass around the corner when he drops deep. He does it for England quite often. But to be able to drop deep and effectively play as a playmaker and then go immediately back to playing as a number nine again, it's a lot easier said than done when you're watching from home. So I was really, really impressed.
Totti-esque, I think. We should remember as well that he had that incredible finish about 3 minutes in for a goal that was then called back for offside, I think, on Son Heung-min. But it was a magnificent spinning volley just to keep his hand in. Spurs have got a busy week. Tuesday, they're at Leighton Orient in the League Cup. Thursday, literally 2 days later, they're at Skendia, you know, in Macedonia, in the Europa League qualifiers. And then they'll have their fourth game in 8 days, hosting Newcastle on Sunday. That's dramatic.
At least they got the easiest one last. That's the main thing.
And then they'll have the same the next week if they get through.
Crikey. So there's League Cup next week as well.
Yeah, and Europa League as well.
Something that was particularly interesting after this game was Ralf Hasenhüttl's statement about being knocked out of the Carabao Cup early. So he mentioned because they were out of the cup, they got knocked out by Brentford. They only have to deal with one game a week until January when the FA Cup starts. It is going to be very, very interesting in this season, I think, when you're trying to get in all those 38 games plus the League Cup, plus the FA Cup into a fixture list that is going to be 5 weeks short. I'm not saying teams are going to tank the League Cup, but I would not be surprised if you see slightly different profiles in some of these early League Cup games from Premier League sides.
Mm. Of course, Spurs do have a big squad of players who could feature in some of those matches who weren't involved in this. Dele Alli, for example. Oh, hang on. Is he on his way to Paris Saint-Germain? Right, said Nick, says, are Spurs right to side with Mourinho against Alli? He's very young and Mourinho could be gone next summer.
It's a confusing one. I don't want to put too much credence on the all or nothing, air quotes, documentary, but that did make Dele Alli look like a particularly poor trainer, or perhaps not the most dedicated person in training. He's definitely been in a downturn of form, and his biggest qualities, sort of this sort of on-the-cuff improvisational style of football, leads me to believe if he can just fall out with a manager like that.
There was also that scene, wasn't there, where he was walking down the tunnel and looking disgruntled, Daniel?
Yeah, he sort of says it's all long ball and ruddy defending, which, yeah, I mean, it's hard because you want footballers to be honest in those documentaries, but Mourinho probably watches that and thinks, well, A, you're criticising my tactics, and B, this is going to be coming out on for every Spurs fan to watch. I think there probably is a kind of natural end to this now, because I don't honestly... It would be nice if Spurs kept Dele Alli, because I think he could be an excellent footballer again, but he hasn't been for 18 months, and he probably does just need that move, I think, to either, you know, help him fall back in love with it or to kick him up the arse, because something needs to change, because he has been kind of coasting for 18 months now, albeit after being massively overplayed when he was 20, 21 years old.
Well, it'll be an exciting move anyway to see him line up with the Parisians. Next up on our grand tour of the round two results, it's off to Goodison Park for another 7-goal thriller between Everton and West Brom.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Yep, another 7-goal game from everyone's favourite, the Premier League. This one was close between Everton and West Brom until Kieran Gibbs shoved James Rodriguez over in a particularly dim-witted gesture. Everton, then facing 10 men, ran riot. Dominic Calvert-Lewin picking up the first hat-trick of his career. 4 goals in 2 games for him now this season. Mark Small says, compared to last campaign, is there anyone who has improved as much as DCL? What do you think, Sash?
Well, according to Carlo Ancelotti after the game, he's turning him into Filippo Inzaghi. Yikes. Oh. Because he said this whole thing about scoring with just one touch. Filippo Inzaghi scored 300 goals, 210 of them with one touch. And what we see this game, what we see the first game, Calvert-Lewin is scoring with one touch. So perhaps he just simplified his game, forget about everything else, just put the ball in the back of the net. Maybe this was the secret behind Filippo Inzaghi that I didn't think of as before, because I thought he was just a clumsy guy who was offside half his life and the other half his life he was scoring goals. But perhaps
greatest trick the devil ever pulled, Sasha.
Exactly. So if Dominic Calvert-Lewin is going to turn into Filippo Inzaghi, I suggest we should all be running for cover.
I owe Calvert-Lewin a little bit of an apology, because at the start of last season when he was operating under Marco Silva, I said he wore number 9, but he's not a number 9. And I think what's happened is, first under Duncan Ferguson, basically telling him to start homing and running around the back post and use that great aerial ability of his. And now with Ferguson and Ancelotti, they are beginning to hone a proper classic number 9. I think in April I ran the numbers for all the English goal scorers during lockdown, and Calvert-Lewin had something like, I think I want to say 13 goals on expected goals of 12. So he is a one-touch bang sort of striker, but he's not. It's not fluke. It's not luck. It's a guy who's doing a lot of hard work. He doesn't dribble the ball too much, because that's Richarlison's job. He doesn't need to press the ball too much, because that's the other Everton player's job. And if he can get properly supplied now, which he probably should, with James, Alan, and Decore behind him, there's no reason why he can't get 20 goals this season. at least.
Carlo Ancelotti is also making heading sexy again, in that the number of headed goals has kind of gone down in the Premier League over the last 5-6 years, right the way back as the kind of rise of foreign managers and passing possession football. But Everton are incredibly good in the box. I think Calvert-Lewin is first and Richarlison is third for headed shots on target since the start of last season in the Premier League. They've got Luca Dean that plays a brilliant ball in from set pieces or open play. They've now got Hammers to do that from the other side. And the football is still really watchable. It's not front to back long ball. It's crosses into the box, and it's not Liverpool crosses into the box, kind of pullbacks to the edge of the 6-yard box. It's proper crosses into the box. And I think where Calvert-Lewin's really improved, as Carl kind of alluded to, is it's the movement in the box. It's meeting the ball. We saw that for the goal last weekend against Spurs. He seems to meet the ball at the perfect point to head home the chance. He doesn't have to kind of crane his neck or anything. He's running full pelt onto a ball to finish it. So, yeah, I agree with the original tweet. I think he's the most improved Premier League player since the start of last season.
He's deadly in the box. James Rodriguez from outside the box, where he does his business, bagging his first goal for the Toffees.
Too much space, and I think we saw it in the first game. He was afforded too much space this game when he scored and when he effectively set up the fourth, I think. He has a lot of time on the ball to play those killer passes. So I think better teams will probably, I mean, if you look at Bielsa will probably have someone man-marking him, and maybe someone else will be coming in to close him down, because I think at the moment, a little bit too much space. And I think also Allen, somewhat worryingly, got left completely behind play for when West Brom actually got the first goal. So I still think there's a few things to sort out there, and I would like to see how James does against the better teams in this division, because I think defensively all three teams that have gone up, but particularly West Brom, are absolutely horrible.
Well, the derby's coming up, Sash.
Yeah, I think so. And I think Everton, you know, notwithstanding what I said about, for example, West Brom not being particularly great, I think Everton, there's certain enthusiasm, joie de vivre, they're playing football, they're good to watch, which hasn't really happened for many, many years. And I think they always, I mean, for the last decade, Everton approach, I think, the derby with trepidation. And I think this time, there should be quite a lot of optimism just in the way they're playing football. Of course, they're going to have a few more weeks to actually get the system better, get it a bit tighter, think about what to do when James comes under a lot of pressure. I think someone like Richarlison can provide the movement off the ball to perhaps open up gaps. And also, I think, you know, it is significant that I think it's actually the match day, which will be the 10th anniversary of the last Everton derby win. So I think they have a chance this year.
Wow. As you say, there's a way to go before that comes around. That's in three fixtures time on the 17th of October. Before that, Everton will be away at Palace and then home to Brighton. Brighton, who we'll speak of very, very soon. A very quick word, though, for the Baggies, who had Slaven Bilic sent off for his protestations over Kieran Gibbs's red card. They had a couple of wonderful goals in this game. Diangana, who actually opened the scoring.
They did, but they Sasha referenced it there, but all three promoted sides, and West Brom included, they've not signed defenders, really. You know, Leeds signed Robin Koch, but had already lost Ben White. West Brom have...
They've signed Ivanovic.
Yeah, they signed Branislav Ivanovic, but they've lost Nathan Ferguson, who was a decent right-back as well. Fulham have signed Anthony Robinson and Kenny Tete and Ola Aina, but only one of them has made a matchday squad yet. Those three clubs have already had 90 shots. They've already allowed 90 shots this season. That's an enormous number to say that they've played each other in one of those games. And the one benefit of this transfer window ending after the season started is it kind of sharpens the mind on what needs to be done. And all three of those clubs, but particularly West Brom, are going to have to buy some players if they indeed care too much about staying in the Premier League or are happy to kind of bank the money.
Meanwhile, at the other end of the scale, a lot of teams are going to win the league this year. Everton, Palace and Arsenal, who are now 2-for-2 in terms of victories. Just like they were last season, actually, when they then won just two of their next 12 matches. But anyway, this victory this weekend came at home to West Ham. And while they did collect the 3 points, it wasn't an easy journey to that result. Mikel Antonio equalising for the beleaguered Hammers. Since the Premier League resumed in June, by the way, no player has scored more goals in the division than Mikel Antonio. That's 9, level with Raheem Sterling. Remarkable stuff. The game was eventually won, touchingly, by a nice little combination between Ceballos and Nketiah, the two who had been in that shoving match in the warm-up at Craven Cottage the previous weekend. Love for Arsenal, anyone? Carl.
I am a man of spreadsheets and XG and X's and O's, so perhaps I am over-evaluating Arteta because he wears a nice turtleneck and talks about things like body position. But Arsenal do seem to be growing something quite nice there. They won that one quite ugly, but they did win it in a way that previous Arsenal sides, perhaps last season, would not have won. They're going to run... I'm still not quite sure if they have enough to get into top four, but they're going to run it awful close this year. And that quiet revolution of Mikel Arteta is beginning to get loud.
Next weekend, Arsenal are going to be at Anfield, so that'll be exciting. Meantime, talking about revolutions, let's talk about Graham Potter's Brighton, who went to Newcastle and came home with a fat 3-0 win. We mentioned in our previous show the remarkable statistics of when Newcastle faced Brighton. Six times it's happened, or seven times now, and they haven't won any of them. And in six of the games now, they have failed to score a single goal. In fact, in this game, they failed to register a single shot on target.
Yeah, there was an excellent tweet from Craig Hope, Newcastle writer, who said that we're supposed to be living in a time when you don't make unnecessary journeys, and Matt Ryan has just travelled 350 miles to Newcastle with nothing to do. Brighton were excellent, and they look well coached. Newcastle's entire attacking strategy appeared to be try and hit the chest of Andy Carroll and then hope something rebounds off it while he stands still, unable to then get in the penalty area to complete the move. It was absolutely dismal. It really was. And I know we've criticised Steve Bruce, and I probably over-criticised him, and he proved me wrong for long periods of last season. But when you see games like that, I mean, I know fans weren't in the ground, but when supporters watch games like that, there just looks to be absolutely no kind of forethought as to what Newcastle are trying to do. It looked like a manager who had turned to his assistant and said, well, we'll pick the same team as last week because we won last week. And Brighton just picked them apart. They just made them look so, so ordinary. And that's what Graham Potter does. The recruitment's brilliant there. He's got Dan Ashworth doing the recruitment. We talk about clubs that could really do with a director of football and everyone pulling in the right direction. And that's what's happening at Brighton at the moment. And you kind of root for them and hope it succeeds, because they took a risk by sacking Chris Hughton, and at the moment there's not many better clubs to watch in the Premier League.
They're a likeable side, and none more likeable than Tarek Lamptey.
Yeah, he's good, isn't he? He's beginning to get a bit targeted physically from other players, but he looks like the real deal. Chelsea fans are making strange noises, saying they may have sold their best right back, or let go their best right back, as it were, but I think he's just a joy to watch. Watching Brighton evokes the same feeling that I got when I was watching good Southampton last season, where it takes your brain about 10 minutes to realise it's not the other team underperforming, but Brighton, in this case, doing a job very, very well.
So should we go easy on Steve Bruce then, Carl?
No, never.
All right then.
But it also seems to be fairly fashionable to knock out the opposition in the first 6-7 minutes and then ask them, go on, what can you do? And obviously, Newcastle's case, not very much. But I thought it was just really impressive the way they surgically picked apart Newcastle's left flank, took the two chances, and then just went, yeah, go on. What can you do? And just saw the game out really comfortably for 80-odd minutes, which I thought was very, very impressive.
A couple of other games to mention. One, the battle of the newly promoted sides at Elland Road, as Leeds saw a Fulham 4-3. 2-2 for Patrick Bamford, who had previously scored just one goal in 27 Premier League appearances for variously Borough, Burnley, Norwich and Palace. He's another of these players who's been improved by a manager, is he?
Or perhaps he's still playing against the Championship side in this particular case.
You mean...
maybe I'm being mean, but this was a game of absolutely horrific defending.
But the other goal came against Liverpool, though, Sash.
Well, that was some also horrific defending there as well. I thought this was appalling. In fact, quite interesting. Bielsa said after the game that they're not really creating enough; they're just converting everything. But at the back, even with Cooper's return, pointlessly giving away penalties, leaving gaps in midfield, goalkeeper flapping for Fulham. Like for every Leeds goal, you could say that they were horrific mistakes. But for the fourth one, the Fulham defense just wanders around. And I have no idea how they're planning to stay up at this rate, because they haven't got a defensive midfielder to actually protect the back line. Last week was a massive deja vu because of the whole back line making errors. This week he made changes. I mean, he brought Areola, as if changing the goalkeeper with that in front of him is going to help anything. And I mean, Parker after the game spoke about, you know, having the right mindset. Mm. How about having the right players?
Right. He was talking about red lights needing to go off. Fulham, who famously conceded 81 goals in their last Premier League campaign and 85 goals in the one before that, will be lucky to get away with such a low total based on their first two results. Seven goals conceded in two so far anyway.
Yeah, he mentioned he said they need the red light and they need to be able to smell danger.
Smell danger.
Which I thought was a very nice interview. Daniel, I think you were the one who wrote about Fulham getting relegated because their squad was too weird. And then when they came up again, they were not going to have a weird squad and not going to do a Fulham. And then they went down again. Their squad now is the opposite to that, where there's absolutely no odd flavouring whatsoever. It's very rudimentary and very championship quality.
I feel like they've just kind of almost got promoted by accident in that, you know, speaking to a few Fulham fans I know, and if they hadn't got promoted, Scott Parker would almost certainly have been sacked. Or certainly been under extraordinary pressure to start this season well. And they did brilliantly after lockdown and got promoted, and Parker immediately signs a new contract. And they've still got a championship squad with a championship manager. And I mean, I said last week, maybe there are signs this year or clubs this year who, because of the financial climate as it is, might think, well, let's just bank our Premier League money. Let's not spend it and probably go down. Let's not spend it and almost certainly go down. And know we've got a sustainable business model for the next 5 years. Maybe that's what they're doing, which isn't very interesting for the rest of us, but I kind of can hardly blame them.
Finally then, the team that is currently sitting on top of the Premier League, at least until we get onto Monday's games, Leicester and their 4-2 win over Burnley. Who cares to sum this up?
Brendan Rodgers coaches his side to have a go, and they're doing a bootleg version of Manchester City, and it's going quite well. But when the tails are up, it's good. When the tails are down, it gets weird. So let's see what happens when things get weird.
All right, then. Well, next weekend, they're going to be away at Manchester City. City, of course, who are yet to feature in this season. They skipped game week one, and their game week two fixture comes up on Monday evening when they are going to be away at Wolves, against whom they lost both their fixtures last season. That's coming up later on Monday, as is Aston Villa's first game of this campaign, which will see them up against Sheffield United in a replay of the match which saw them stay up in the top division last season by the skin of their teeth. You remember, this was the first game back after the restart when the goal line technology didn't work and a Sheffield United goal wasn't counted. And that's why Villa is still with us in the Premier League. All right, well, looking forward to those games. We'll be discussing them, of course, in Thursday's edition of the Totally Football Show. Still to come today, very shortly, James Horncastle will be telling us all about one of the big breaking stories from the European weekend. First of all, though, let's get some odds on the games coming up from Lee Price.
Hello, listeners. That was a chaotic weekend, wasn't it? Goals almost everywhere, which you can see continuing tonight in one of the games, at least. Wolves versus City reeks of goals, and there's odds on there's at least three here, with City similarly better than evens to win the game, which is bookie speak for their favourites. Who'd have known? Wolves have lost Diogo Jota from their attack, but City still haven't gained an all-conquering centre-back at the time of recording, so 11-2 for the home win looks tantalising and long, a bit like an Adama Traore stride. Before that match, on the undercard, or how a football works these days, is Villa versus Sheffield United, the Blades having lost to Wolves last weekend. Villa got off without having to play City, lucky boys, which might explain why the villains are favourites. We all have a good anti-hero, don't we? Just not Jack Grealish. With Dean Smith's men 8-5 to win this. We've hardly written Sheffield United off, though. We'd be too scared to. Have you seen Chris Wilder on the VAR rant? It's 9-5 for an away win. And yes, it's odds on that won't be the only VAR reference in the build-up to this game. Strap yourselves in.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Now, the Totally Football League show is out on Monday. Will Sabri Lamouchi still be the Nottingham Forest manager by then? Daniel, will he?
Yeah, he will by Monday. He might not be by the following Monday.
Right. Who's it going to be then?
I'd love it to be Eddie Howe, and there are some reasons to believe why that could happen. But with our owner, it could also be a very left field choice from Greek football. So, yeah, your guess is as good as mine.
That sounds exciting. A left field choice from Greek football. All right. Totally Scottish Football Show is out on Tuesday, as is the Totally Football Show's European edition. And it's going to be a busy one with the opening weekend of the Bundesliga. Huge game between Borussia Dortmund and Mönchengladbach, with Bellingham getting an assist on his debut and Sancho in action and all that stuff. Bayern Munich getting things underway with a quick 8-0 over Schalke and our old pal David Wagner. In Serie A, meanwhile, big story of the opening weekend was Andrea Pirlo, never managed a game at any level ever, but here debuting with the Italian champions. How did it go? Let's get a quick heads up from James Horncastle. Hello, James.
Hello, James.
Opening weekend of the Serie A season. There's loads of stories to talk about, and we're going to be doing that on Tuesday. But I got to know, how did Andrea Pirlo's debut go?
Mightily impressive, James, even if it was coming up against the Sampdoria side that flirted with relegation last year and haven't really been able to do all that much so far this summer. But just to see Juventus play with fluidity, play attacking football, create lots of chances. I mean, Claudio Ranieri at the end of the game, the Samp manager, was saying that, three goals flattered Samp in that they should have lost by a bigger scoreline, because certainly in the first half, when Cristiano Ronaldo hit the bar, Aaron Ramsey kept setting him up. And that was one of the stories of the game. Ramsey playing really well in midfield, probably his best performance in the Juventus shirt, along with the one that he put in the Derby d'Italia back in, February, March time. And Juventus just looking in sync already in a very short space of time. Playing tonight, it was 3-2-5 when they've got the ball, with McKennie, who did well in midfield alongside Adrian Rabiot, and Ramsey a little bit further forward. Kulusevski and Ronaldo up front. Kulusevski got the opening goal. Their big €42 million signing from Atalanta, who was sort of bought in January but didn't join until the end of the season. And yeah, three goals, which didn't happen very often under Maurizio Sarri last year, when they kind of made hard work of scoring goals, and a clean sheet as well, which isn't something that happened much under Sarri either. So early days, James, but lots of positives.
Right. Can we already say what Pirlo ball is? Pirlismo.
Well, I think we got a good idea of what Pirlo ball is in his dissertation, which came out last week. He finished his UEFA Pro license. He had an exam at Coverciano, and then they released The Calcio That I Would Like to Play, which was the title of his thesis. And it was very kind of on brand with a lot of the kind of, I'd say, blue chip football teams that we see at the moment that play this, you know, sort of liquid football. That was actually used in the thesis. The partridge liquid football came through. And yeah, I think that's the thing. It's about rotations, interchanges of position. He said tonight that he doesn't think there's a Pirlo in this team, which was one of the quotes that he had after the game. So, we don't have a playmaker. We've got and we don't have guys who are number eights really either. So we're going to build up in a kind of 3+2 kind of way. But yeah, it's all about kind of fluid movement and total complete football, again, which he said. Because one of the things, as well as thanking Roy Hodgson in his thesis for calling him Pirla, which means idiot, probably a charitable translation of that, he cited the kind of teams that really influenced him. And one was Louis van Gaal's Ajax. There was, the Cruyff and Pep's Barcelona, Conte's Juventus, and of course, Carlo Ancelotti's Milan. So I think
and
those
kind
of, and Hodgson. I think they give you a really quite a good flavour of what he's all about. As many talented players in the team as possible, without sacrificing balance. And that was the thing that he was asked about tonight, because De Ligt was still out injured and won't be back for a while. Dybala's still coming back from injury as well. So there weren't a lot of their best players from last year, if you like, their best performances. Right. So how they all fit in is going to be very interesting to follow.
It certainly will. You'll be telling us more about all of that in Tuesday's European edition. Of course, looking forward as well to his second game in charge, which looks a slightly tougher one. They're away at Roma next Sunday evening. One final thing, though. What did he wear on the touchdown? Was it a kind of Sarri-esque tracksuit affair?
No Sarri-esque tracksuit. No Sarri-esque knitted polo shirt, which he tended to sweat into. Pirlo looked immaculate in his Juventus Trussardi suit. And the thing is, he never sweated. He didn't sweat at all. That was the thing that really kind of took me aback in his post-match press conference. He was just ice cool. And that was what Kulusevski said. Yeah, he just transmits kind of calm to you. And
like Prince Andrew, another man who has that.
Indeed. Did he go to Pizza Express for his pre-game meal? We don't know. So.
We don't know. Well, we'll have more on that major story. And the other big stories from around the continent in Tuesday's show, including, of course, a little look forward to Thursday's European Super Cup. Yeah, Bayern Munich against Sevilla. That'll be huge. Anyway, James, look forward to speaking to you then. For now, thank you very much. With that, he was gone, and it's pretty much time for us to go as well, listener. We've got loads of football to tell you about by the time we come back on Thursday. But for now, well done for ploughing through all of those goals to Carl, Daniel and Sasha. Cheers.
Goodbye.
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 Have a lovely week, listener, until we catch up with you again soon. And as the fellas say, it's cheerio.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of The Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
Muddy Knees Media.